This is chapter two of Surfacing, read by A.L. Knorr. This is not a professional recording, so please forgive any mistakes. It's read by the author. In many ways, the Sea Dog was where I grew up. It was home, and even Targa's daycare facility at times. The tourist restaurant floating in Saltford's harbor, modeled after a 16th century bark, was built by Nathan after a flood destroyed the first one. The replacement restaurant was bigger and more elaborately finished than the first, and Nathan's labor was donated. This was before I came out of the ocean for my land cycle, but though I'd missed the construction of it, I could feel Nathan's touch in the polished brass finishings and red lacquered hull. Even locals loved to eat Phil's famous fish and chips during the off-season, when there was finally a way to make it to the toilets without tripping over a purse with a tiny dog in it. Phil took a chance on an inexperienced young woman, me, gave me a job and taught me what forgiveness was, because I made a lot of mistakes. I was a quick study, but I was also a lot more sheltered from the ways of humanity than most young women were, having spent the previous 11 years at sea. Another 11-year period had passed, and I was still waitressing at the Sea Dog, but those days were numbered, and how I dreaded the finish. Phil was getting on in years now, and though he never complained, I could see the stiffness settling into his bones and the stress lines etched into his brow. He longed for his recliner and a condition I didn't yet fully understand and probably never would, known as retirement. "But what are you going to do?" I asked as I polished the hot silverware, fresh from the industrial dishwasher, and lay them in their appropriate drawers. Phil's damp and rosy face reappeared from behind the bar, where he'd been changing one of the hoses. He slid the door shut with a snap. "That's the point. I'm going to do nothing." He put his palms together in prayer and shook them. "The whole reason people work so hard, scrimp and save their whole lives, and pay off their mortgages by the time they're 60 or 65, if they're lucky, is so they can retire and do nothing with the rest of their days." I frowned. "That doesn't sound right to me. Won't you get bored?" "Nope." I shook my head, mystified. Phil wiped down the bar, making the wood gleam. "You've never thought about retirement?" I shook my head, but couldn't justify myself. Mermaids don't retire. They go to the ocean to die, probably somewhere around their 500th or 600th birthday. "You should." He shook his damp rag at me. "You're what, 30? 31. "No spring chicken. Sorry, but you aren't. You look like you're 20, but one day the years will catch up to you and you'll..." He put his hands to his lower back and stretched. Something cracked. "Fall apart." I laughed. "All at once? That's a little extreme." "It comes on fast. You only have one life, Mira. You work hard and raise that beauty of a little girl of yours and maybe find a nice guy." My smile disintegrated. Phil sighed. "It's been 3 years, Mir. No one would begrudge you a relationship. We just want you to be happy." "We? Crystal, me, Nathan's folks, Targa?" He paused. "I'm sure you have lots of other friends." But I didn't, and I didn't have the heart to correct Phil on the facts. Crystal moved to Toronto 2 years after Nathan and I were married. She came back for Nathan's funeral and called once a year or so, but otherwise she wasn't in my life anymore. Nathan's father was ill, so Nathan's mom moved him to a care facility in Florida. They loved Targa, and I had taken her down to visit them a few times, but money was tight for me and for them, so now it had been a year since we'd last seen them. The Sea Dog's door swung open, and Kaylee, another server, blew in and tossed her coat on one of the anchor-shaped iron hooks behind the door. She snapped her gum, and it went off like a gun. Phil visibly winced, and we shared a look. I miss Crystal. I closed up the silverware drawer with my hip, moved to the computer, and booted it up. "She's not that bad," Phil whispered as she clomped across the floor in a pair of knee-high lace-up motorcycle boots and snapped her gum a second time. "No gum, please, Kaylee," he said over his shoulder. "You missed a spot, Phil," she mimicked in a nasal voice before slamming her way through the swinging door and into the kitchen to get her apron. I gave Phil a look of long-suffering, and he agreed with a weary nod. He missed Crystal, too. If I were Phil, I would have fired Kaylee by now. For a while, I was wondering why he put up with her attitude. There were two things at play. One, it was difficult to find and keep good help. And two, Phil was selling the Sea Dog and was counting down the days until he'd be passing the keys over to the new owner. "Why disrupt things with a firing and a hiring?" he told me only the week before, and the deal was already signed. The date was set, and the handover would happen in 4 weeks' time. Phil had assured me that the buyer was a lovely couple from Halifax who would give me a probationary period of 3 months before any final decision would be made about my role here. Great. Phil had no doubt that they would keep me. At 11 years, I was the longest-standing, most trustworthy employee Phil had ever had. I was given the responsibility of manager and a slight bump in pay every year, but no official title, not that I cared. Phil ran with a small crew, 5 servers including himself during the high season. A manager wasn't really needed, aside from himself. What time will they be here? I opened the computer software and set it up for the lunch shift. I'm early for it, but just Clive is coming. His wife can't make it today. Phil looked at his watch. And he's late. I asked him to come at 10 to avoid the lunch rush. Oops. Phil and Clive had arranged a meeting to discuss the paperwork for the sale and for Phil to give Clive a thorough tour of the Sea Dog's inner and outer workings. The front door opened again and a man in a long oilskin jacket and outback hat came in. He might have been imposing in the outfit if it didn't bulge out at the middle over an enormous belly. The phrase "all hat and no cowboy" sprang to mind, and I turned around to hide a smile. Clive! Phil wiped away the look of annoyance and greeted the man with a hearty handshake. Nice to see you could make it, after all. Clive nodded and wheezed. Got tangled up in traffic at Hope's Corner. You know what that intersection can be like. Clive shrugged out of his oilskin and draped it on a hook. He kept the hat on. Indeed, said Phil conspiratorially as they sat down to a table. Hope's Corner was an intersection at the end of the shopping district where Pepper Street ran into the first suburb and became Hope Street. It was never blocked up with traffic. On the heels of Clive, 5 men entered next. 3 of them were wearing baseball jackets in the identical shade of azure. There was a logo on the arm of each jacket, but it was difficult to make out in the folds. The door to the kitchen opened and Kelsey came out, snapping her gum. Ooh, men flesh. I'll take this one. Kelsey ignored many of the rules of engagement Phil had put into place for his servers. It used to be that all tips went into a shared pot and were split at the end of the night, but servers grumbled if they felt they'd worked hardest and didn't get to share the share they deserved. So he switched it to the servers receiving the tips of the tables they took care of. Seniority took the first table to sit down, and it alternated after that. It was irritating that Kelsey behaved in this selfish way, but I couldn't stand to cry off to Phil. He didn't need the extra stress. And did it really matter? Just hearing the petty words, "Kelsey isn't playing fair," come from my own mouth would have made my skin crawl. It wasn't worth it. So I just led her sachet over to the table of men as they chose a booth near the ship's wheel and settled in. The group seemed happy about something, talking and laughing, their faces sunburned and lively. They grinned up at Kelsey as she took their drinks order. Someone said something funny and the table exploded with laughter. I made my way across to where Phil and Clive were sitting and asked if they'd like a drink. "Thanks, Mira," said Phil appreciatively and a little surprised. "I'd love a ginger ale." I swung my attention to Clive. He was staring at my chest, his jaw slack and mouth hanging open. His cheeks were tomato red and a trickle of sweat trickled down the side of his neck and disappeared between folds of fat. "Clive?" Phil shot me an apologetic look. "Would you like a drink?" Clive came to life. "Ah, yes, how kind of you. On you, of course." Phil colored a little. "Of course," he murmured. Annoyance zinged through me. Clive craned his neck to scan the bar. "What have you got for single malt scotch?" I blinked. "Hard liquor before noon?" I rattled off a few brands we carried, and Clive chose the most expensive one. I turned for the bar, rolling my eyes, and that's when he slapped me on the ass. Hard. "Atta girl," he wheezed as the smack resounded through the restaurant. I froze in disbelief. In 11 years of serving, I'd been flirted with, hit on, and asked out too many times to count, but never had I been handled or treated with such blatant disrespect. Clive didn't know me. He didn't know that I'd broken up 4 bar fights and bounced at least a dozen men twice my size from the Sea Dog. I had a reputation, which even tourists picked up on if they mingled with enough locals. I turned stiffly back to the table, catching a glimpse of Phil's horror. I made a fist, but Phil was on his feet. "Out!" he stormed. "Get out of my ship! Forget the scotch, forget the deal!" He reached across the table and grabbed Clive by the shirt collar, heaving. There's no way petite Phil could lift Clive, but it didn't matter. Clive was on his feet, huffing and puffing and turning purple. "This is still my place." "No, it isn't. We signed the paperwork," Clive bellowed back, and the 2 men stumbled toward the door, Phil shoving and Clive tottering. I noticed the table of men in blue jackets had paused and were watching with interest and some mirth. It looked like an irate, grizzled gerbil was escorting a sweating walrus to the door, both of them yipping at one another. Clive stumbled over the runner and crashed into the wall below the coat hooks, grabbing his jacket on the way down. The sound of cracking wood echoed through the ship as Clive pulled the line of coat hooks out of the wall and crumpled to a heap on the floor. He thrashed to get up, his hat jammed crookedly over one eye. He finally heaved himself to his feet and found his oilskin. "You'll be hearing from my lawyer," he belted, his face apoplectic with rage. He straightened his hat and opened the door. "Just try it," Phil barked. "You'll be staring down the barrel of a sexual harassment charge." He slammed the door, and the remaining screw holding the hooks to the wall decided to give, and it fell to the hardwood with a clank. Phil turned, nostrils flaring. "I'm sorry about that, Mira." I bent to pick up the coat rack and the few jackets it had been holding. "Don't worry about it," I murmured. Truthfully, I was both shocked and touched. Phil had needed the deal to go through, and he also knew I could handle myself. He hadn't needed to interfere on my behalf. I might have been making a fist, but I hadn't been intending on hitting Clive. I wondered if Phil had reacted first to prevent me from beating his buyer to a pulp. It wasn't the first time Phil had come to my defense, but it was the most dramatic. The Sea Dog's owner was gentle, a pacifist who hated conflict in any form. I turned to carry the coat hook to Phil's office and until the wall could be fixed, and nearly ran into one of the men in blue jackets. "You all right, miss?" he said, his round face concerned and tinged with pink. That took us all a little by surprise there. He had that lyrical way of speaking which most locals had. The East Coast Canadian accent was unpretentious and warm. "I'm fine." I passed by him and remembered my nanners. "Thank you," I said with a smile. He nodded and went back to his table, sliding into the booth where his friends were already talking and laughing again. I passed Kelsey on the way to Phil's office. She'd missed the whole event and came out of the kitchen completely oblivious. "They're treasure hunters," she hissed at me in obvious delight. "Probably rich as Midas." I blanked out for a second until I realized she was talking about the men in the blue jackets. She balanced a tray of food on a single flat palm, held up by her ear, and swayed her hips dramatically as she approached their table. Phil came up behind me and took the coat hook from me. "They're not treasure hunters," his tone was exasperated, as it usually was when Kelsey was involved. "They're salvage divers. Honestly," he mumbled to himself as he disappeared into his office to deposit the coat hook. I peered at the men with curiosity. When Phil returned from his office, I probed for more information. "What kind of salvage?" "You don't know Simon?" I shook my head. "Never saw him before, or any of them." "He grew up here, though he was gone for quite a few years, working for a larger salvage crew on the other side of the country. He returned and started Blue Jackets. Thinks there's need in the East. They're still small, mostly subcontract to larger companies, I think, but he's got big dreams, that lad." "Salvage of shipwrecks?" Phil rocked his head back and forth. "Sometimes. I think that's what he'd like to do the most of. It's more fun than dragging a truck out of a river that some drunk teenager has wrecked." He blew out a sigh. "I'm sure he takes whatever work comes along, though, like most of us." The heavy tone of Phil's voice drew my attention away from the dive team. "What are you going to do now that the sale is null?" Phil chewed his lip, his brow furrowing with worry. "Honestly, I think I have to wait and see if Clive holds true in his threat. He's got a copy of the contract, and he's right. We signed it last week. If he wants to, he has legal grounds to take me to court for breach of contract." "Would you really charge him with sexual harassment?" "I don't want any trouble," Phil grumbled. "If I had to, I suppose I would. But I sure hope he just goes away. I've got enough on my plate, and it looks like my retirement plans are shot until I find another buyer." Phil suddenly looked very old, and I think the consequences of breaking the deal with Clive really sunk home. "I'll be in my office." He closed the door behind him.